Welcome to another edition of Valley Voices, underwritten by Grassroots Community Network at grassrootstv.org. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host, and joining me today are Sloan Shoemaker, outgoing director of Wilderness Workshop, and Will Rausch, who will be taking the helm of the organization later this summer. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks, Amy. Good to be here.
Well, this is sort of an historic moment, I think, for Wilderness Workshop. It's an historic moment for the public lands movement in the Roaring Fork Valley and in Western Colorado. And, you know, Sloan, I was around when Beverly Compton stepped down as Aspen Wilderness Workshop director, and you took over about 20 years ago, 21?
Yep, that's about right.
Okay. Talk about how it felt to take on the organization at that time.
Well, it's funny. I wasn't executive director when I was a single staff person because there's nobody to direct. And it wasn't until we hired a second staff person that the guy that had been there longer was named executive director.
And
I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I knew the work. I knew the conservation work inside and out. But how to run an organization was not something I was prepared for. And so it was a little daunting, frankly. And one of the lessons I learned along the way was to lean into it. Lean into being the director rather than leaning away.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think I spent a lot of time leaning away because I wasn't sure about what I was doing and how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, it was just like, just lean into it. Oh, okay. And then, you know, stop turning and turn towards it, right? And so that's when it started really working for me. But when I first started, I was passionate about a mission and a job, and I was very focused on what was right in front of me. I didn't anticipate this becoming a 21-year career. I'm glad I didn't because I probably would have freaked out.
It's hard to see what's coming at you.
Yeah,
and focus
on and
that.
You know, and I was as a solo staff person, my salary was our budget was $30,000 a year, which wasn't much. And at some point, things were coming too fast, and I was like, look, I can't continue doing this. I'm saying to the board, unless I get some help. Because there's a lot more to do than I'm capable of doing. A lot of things are falling through the cracks here. Mm-hmm. And I wrote out a 5-year plan and met it in 3 years. And, you know, and I got the board all on the same page and rowing in the same direction, if you mix metaphors. And it worked. And, you know, we started bringing on staff in a very strategic manner and ramping up our fundraising and shifting the board from a volunteer board that was very involved in program and projects to a more of a fundraising and ambassador board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were liaisons to the community and providing, you know, guidance and oversight to me to help me learn the ropes of being a director and running an organization.
Aspen Wilderness Workshop, when you started, was small and sort of a hyper-local group.
Yeah.
And what kind of vision did you have for Wilderness Workshop, and how did you move it into what it is now?
Good question. Well, what I was initially hired to do was to draft a citizens management alternative for the forest plan.
So the
conservation community said, we don't want to only have the option of looking what alternatives the Forest Service presents to the community in the draft EIS, the forest plan. We want to put forward a proactive vision of what we think conservation of public lands in the White River National Forest looks like. And I got drafted to do that, which was a great way to get my feet wet and my whole body wet because it was 2.3 million acres. And this plan governs what happens on every acre and everything, soup to nuts, you know. And so it was a great training ground for me to cut my teeth on. And at the time, the science of conservation biology, which is all about ensuring that evolution is allowed to continue, basically, and continue both with species and their relationship to the landscape. And it's about creating enough space for those animals to continue to have those evolutionary processes of gene pool mixing and evolving over time in response to changing environmental circumstances. Anyway, conservation biology was a proactive vision that was coming onto the scene in the mid to late 90s when I was studying this public lands conservation. Mm-hmm. And that became the model we used for the forest plan. And it became the model sort of that we've built the workshops conservation program around. Large protected core areas that are connected to other protected core areas. So you've got, you know, gene interaction mm-hmm. between the different populations. So that governed sort of the conservation program. And the Aspen Wilderness Workshop had, which was founded in 1967 in Aspen by the three Bells, mm-hmm. as we call them, Connie, Joy, and Dottie. They had done a great job of getting wilderness designation all around Aspen. So that kind of the work was done up there.
Right.
But then we became very conscious of the fact that wilderness boundaries were essentially drawn at 10,000 foot elevation, you know, with some exceptions.
And rock and ice.
Yeah, rock mm-hmm. and ice. And those are great lands for scenery and recreation and summer habitat for our large ungulates or deer and elk, for instance, and bear. But biologically, they aren't as rich as some of the lower lands. And we started looking at those lower lands, and areas like what became the Thompson Divide became mm-hmm. a real focus because mm-hmm. that is extraordinarily rich mid to lower elevation landscape that it goes from sagebrush grasslands up and through aspen and into some dark timber, but doesn't ever really poke out into the rock and ice mm-hmm. like our existing wilderness does. And so we started looking for conservation strategies around some of these lower elevation lands and to make sure they were connected across the landscape so that while animals had, there was a permeability so animals could move across the landscape. So that's kind of the conservation vision. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, well, how the heck are we going to do this? And you know,
right, that's huge.
There's a national, international movement, you know, that's working on wildlands conservation. That your friend and
it's
mine,
Dave Foreman
mm-hmm. is sort of the ringleader of. So there's a lot of coaching and guidance coming in from that level. But it was also like, let's just think about this. What do we got to do? We need to raise more money. How do you do that? Well, you tell people your story. And so we brought in Dave Reed, who was a great storyteller. He was a former journalist at the Aspen Daily News. We brought him in, and he started telling our story. He started writing it. He started telling it verbally. And eventually, we just slowly built it up and got more membership. Mm-hmm. When I first came aboard the Wilderness Workshop, or the Aspen Wilderness Workshop at the time, our membership was below 100. And they were literally, we were losing members because some of them were passing away. Mm-hmm. And so we needed to reverse that trend. And we also needed to move out of the sort of the scarcity frugality paradigm right. into more of an abundance, you know, possibility paradigm, meaning it with fundraising. So our all-volunteer organization prior to me being the first full-time staff person was spending very little money, doing everything on a penny. And our founders were very frugal penny pinchers, and good for them. But after a while, that just doesn't work anymore. Yeah. And so we with a little bit of growing pains, we transitioned from that real penny pinching attitude to like, you got to spend money to make money or to mm-hmm. make progress. Mm-hmm. And we strategically brought on board members who got that, who would help with fundraising and help with our relationships and outreach into the community. And, and just built from there.
Yeah, really built from there. You came on in 2009, is that correct?
Yeah, the summer of 2009. Okay. I started traipsing around the forest inventorying lands for what was then the Hidden Gems Wilderness Proposal.
Oh, the Hidden Gems Wilderness Proposal. I remember that project. That was one project that really didn't take off.
I'll respectfully disagree.
Okay.
You're correct that the entirety of the Hidden Gems Citizens Wilderness Proposal has not been signed by the president. But that project started out very broadly across the entire forest and even to the south of us on the mm-hmm. Gunnison Forest, some lands around Crested Butte. Mm-hmm. And that original citizens proposal now has, you know, two very mature campaigns in both the Senate and the House for new wilderness and actually much broader than that, new public lands protection. So there's not a lot right around Carbondale in the Roaring Fork Valley. But to the south of us in Gunnison County, there's a proposal that Senator Bennett's working on for hundreds of thousands of acres of protection. Mm-hmm. And over in Summit and Eagle counties, there's bills in both the House and the Senate that would protect almost 100,000 acres as well over there.
Those came out of the Hidden Gems Project.
That's right.
I didn't know that. Well, Hidden Gems was controversial, I think. I know, Sloan, you've never been afraid of controversy, at least outwardly. But it seems to me that that's probably one of the most controversial projects that Wilderness Workshop has initiated. Am I right?
No, I'd agree. And maybe not a big surprise. Protecting public lands can get controversial. And especially when you're working on a project that's trying to put in place kind of the gold standard of land protection that in, you know, kind of by design is more restrictive of uses. So you run into more people who either have an economic or just a personal interest in those uses continuing, whether it's oil and gas, snowmobiling, hard rock mining, timber extraction, mountain biking. There's a whole lot of people who are wary of new wilderness protections, and that's always been the case.
Also, we were targeting lower elevation lands because of their biological richness. And targeting lower elevation lands is getting closer to communities where people live. Mm-hmm. And those are lands that have a longer history of different types of uses. And so, you know, we kind of stuck our foot right into the, you know.
Right in
nest.
It.
Yeah, right. And, you know, I don't think we anticipated the level of controversy that
really
brewed up. And there were some lessons learned. I think that I will admit I was a little bit naive about it. But I also think there was a sort of a national political context that had people worked up. That was about the time that the healthcare discussions were going on in 2006, 2007, 2008, about the time the Tea Party was forming. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of agitation and energy, you know, on the more conservative end of the spectrum that pivoted to the Hidden Gems campaign.
Okay.
And, you know, frankly, I'd love to have that conversation again because I think there are a lot of misunderstandings on both sides of that. It'd be nice if we could have another conversation around the whole thing with a little cooler temperature.
Well, you told Scott Condon of the Aspen Times that the conversation got off on the wrong foot.
I think that's probably fair to say. Okay. And that's one of the lessons we learned is that rather than And we thought we were doing the right thing. We went on the land, we inventoried. This is what Will was talking about earlier. This is what he was hired to do, is look at those lands that we think, you know, based on our reading of the Wilderness Act, qualified for a wilderness designation, and then wrap that up in a pretty little package and draw nice maps and, you know, and then roll it out into the community and say, here are all the places that we think warrant wilderness. Let's have a conversation about that. Well, what it turned out to do was to create a map with bullseyes all over it that people were just taking shots at.
Yeah.
And then the process became one of whittling and cutting and, you know, and counterclaims. Mm-hmm. So I think to start the conversation next time, I would say we all have an interest and a stake in public lands. Let's figure out a way that we can all look at the map and look at what's important to us and look at the spectrum of possibilities here and figure out ways where we can walk away where everybody gets what they need.
That's what happened with Thompson Divide, is it not?
I don't know if the gas companies would say that, but
right.
Yeah, I think in the case of the Thompson Divide, our work there, I mean, in some ways it was similar. It was pulling people together and drawing maps and refining boundaries, and that was in both cases, but there was a much bigger, more immediate threat in the Thompson Divide that I think really helped to unify people. And that threat largely came from outside of the valley in the area. And there was very little benefit to people locally of the, you know, that would come along with oil and gas development.
The other thing was that the protections we were seeking didn't really affect the current users, the current stakeholders. They were really just purely targeting oil and gas development on that land. So it was basically status quo, let's prevent oil and gas development here. And so people they're losing their current piece of the pie.
Right. So the motorized vehicle recreationists weren't told to stay out, or the mountain bikers or whatever, the ranchers, the cows, that kind of thing.
Right.
I'd like to take a brief break. You're listening to Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, and my guests today are Sloan Shoemaker and Will Rausch, who is the incoming director of the organization.
It was really interesting as the Hidden Gems campaign controversy was unfolding. We were simultaneously building this broad, diverse stakeholder group with the Thompson Divide effort. And I, and something people around here don't know much about, I was working with the Colorado Bark Beetle Cooperative over in Summit County, but really it's a 10-county area dealing with how to build consensus around the priorities for mitigating the mountain pine beetle epidemic that hit Summit County and Eastern Eagle County and Jackson and Rout and all those counties. And, you know, and ate its way through 4 million acres of lodgepole pine forest. We sat at this big table collaborating, building consensus to the point where this broad, diverse stakeholder set went to D.C., got the entire Colorado congressional delegation to sit down in the room for an hour and listen to our pitch. I was sitting next to the person from the timber industry. We were saying the exact same thing. The outcome was that we got $55 million scheduled to Colorado to mitigate the priorities that we'd agreed to in this consensus building exercise, which was really remarkable. And so anyway, it was a funny place for me to be in, to be in the hot seat of Hidden Gems and concurrently watching these two collaboration efforts build very successfully on the flanks of it.
I think interestingly with the Hidden Gems Wilderness Campaign and other efforts, there's often a period where it's more controversial as people are learning about it. I think interestingly enough, kind of right as it started to taper off was about the time we'd pretty much reached consensus. And what you see happening is that where that happened in Summit County in, in basically the second congressional district, we reached consensus and moved forward with a bill because we had a congressman who wanted to move that forward, and we continued working some things out, and it's it's moved on. And essentially the same in Gunnison County. Senator Michael Bennett said, let's move this forward under a slightly different process. So I think in a lot of ways, if we'd had a different representative for the third district of Colorado, there would be something. It wouldn't be called the Hidden Gems because that's the citizens' proposal. It'd be called, you know, the Western Colorado Recreation and Protection Act or something like that, and it would look different. But it would have moved forward because we came to a place with the motorized community where there was just a few small little things we were kind of figuring out, and the same with the mountain bike community.
And so our representative, Scott Tipton, didn't act, or?
Yeah, he's never demonstrated really any real interest in wilderness protection, with the exception of the Hermosa Creek bill in southern Colorado, where he kind of came in later in the process.
But to be fair, Representative Salazar was in that seat during a lot of this too, and he was scared of his own shadow, and he wouldn't touch it.
That kind of work is so, well, it's obviously very important, and it's very difficult. You know, when you think of environmental, I mean, do you guys consider yourselves environmentalists?
Yeah, I would think when I describe myself, I use the word conservationist more often in some ways because I think it's a little more narrow and specific to the work we do.
Right.
And environmentalist has a very broad context, but I'd include myself in that personally for sure.
Well, because I think when some people think about environmentalist, they don't think about all of the things that you're talking about, bringing people to consensus, reaching across the aisle, so to speak, or across the fence, or, you know, trying to bring people together about public lands or protecting wilderness. That's the work that I find very difficult.
It's the nature of public lands that it requires a democratic process to make progress on, because they belong to all of us. We work at the federal government level because these are federal public lands, and all of our elected representatives want to be sure that they are hearing from all of the stakeholders in their constituency. And so our perception of our job was to do as much work as possible for them, to make it easy as possible for them to pick it up and carry it. Of course, they had to do their own vetting and their own due diligence. So that's why we charge ourselves with sort of engaging this democratic process.
Will Rausch, what are the most urgent issues that Wilderness Workshop needs to take a look at?
I think there's probably two answers to that question. One is a lot of the national issues that we're hearing so much about. I think it's our job to help the community stay informed and to take action on those. And those kind of run the gamut, you know, all the way from threats to our climate to efforts to privatize public lands to initiatives to reduce citizen participation in the democratic process of public lands management. But our bread and butter is really our local geography, and it can be hard to predict exactly what those most urgent threats are. But for instance, you know, several months ago, we weren't even aware that there was a huge expansion to a limestone quarry just above Glenwood. And that may become a big chunk of work. We've heard that there'll be increased timber targets on national forests across the country that will affect us here on the White River. And right now, we don't see a lot of timber sales or logging on the forest.
It's a wilderness. For a while.
Yeah, it's a wilderness and recreation forest, but we're expecting more of that. Our oil and gas program, I think, will continue. The price of oil and gas is going up, and we've got an administration that's very favorable to that industry, so there's not kind of those big picture economic, political pressures that probably reduce that threat in previous years. So I think we'll continue that work.
Okay. What are you most excited about, Will?
I guess I'm most excited about the opportunity to continue engaging our members, but also to expand into kind of new groups. We've got a program called Defiende, which is reaching out to the Latino community. And we're just sticking our toes in the water, but we held a picnic down in Glenwood a few weeks ago, and there weren't a huge amount of people, but the people who were there were really interested in what we were doing.
Right.
And so that was encouraging and exciting. We're starting to do more work in the Eagle Valley, and so we want to really make sure we're resourcing our full geography as much as possible.
Any advice for Will Sloan?
No, I don't.
That's
not a question I was prepared to answer. I don't know yet. Let me think about that.
Okay, you have 10 seconds.
The best advice that was given to me by some board members when I was unsure of my way was to trust my instinct. And because they saw in me that I had good instincts that I couldn't see. And I see the same in you, Will. And I think you probably generally do trust your instincts really well, but I think you have great instincts and trust them, because there's going to be a lot of people pushing you around in lots of different directions. And you're going to have to be the calm center of the storm.
How does that feel, Will?
I think it's good advice. And I mean, I haven't felt like I'm in the center of the storm yet. I'm sure I'll get there. But, you know, one of the other things I've been telling people who ask me about the transition is it's a really great time to become the director of the Wilderness Workshop.
Why?
The organization is as healthy and strong and robust and supported by the community as it has been, I'd say. And the issues that we're working on are of, you know, the most importance that they've been in a very long time, if not ever, too. So it's important work with an organization that's set up to do it. So I'm excited about that, too. Got a great staff and wonderful board, and people come up to me and say, you know, that's just great. You're going to be, you know, at this organization. And I think that's a testament to the organization.
Yeah. What qualities are you looking for in a conservation director? I know you guys are looking for one since you're moving on.
Absolutely. We're hiring. Mm-hmm. Send us your resume. There's a whole bunch. There's a whole list on our website. But maybe the two most important is a real kind of technical knowledge or history experience in public lands, environmental conservation, advocacy issues. Doesn't have to be all of those, but somebody who can kind of hit the ground running.
Okay.
But also the ability to listen, to build consensus, to work in the community. That's what this work is. I wish it was running around in the woods looking for animals, but we're running around the community trying to protect the animals.
Right.
And so the person needs to be good at working with other people.
Sort of like an organizer.
Yeah, I think we've got an organizer, and certainly the conservation director should have those instincts and maybe some of that in the background, but it's maybe a little bit more of a consensus builder, you know, really an ability to understand where other people are coming from. At the heart of it, our work is to try and influence people.
Okay.
And to do that, I think you have to meet them where they are, understand what motivates them, and that's not one trait, but that gives you
that's
a sense, I hope.
Well, one final question. I have a lot of questions we didn't get to, but for you, Sloan, what's next?
Well, I don't have another job waiting in the wings. Immediately, I'm going to eddy out for a little while and take some time to myself and to my family. I've got two teenage girls that will be gone before long. And I've got a wife who's been such a solid supporter of me through this 21-year career, who I want to now return the favor to. She's growing her business. I've got some aging parents that won't be here much longer either. And I want to spend some time taking care of myself. Then we'll see what happens. I'm going to stick with the workshop, doing some special projects that I've started and I want to see through. But it's a very small amount of time. And I'm always available for a phone call and consultation with Will or the board or whoever needs me. If they don't need me, then I'm just as happy with that. What I found is that the workshop is in the public eye, and being a small community, I was very closely identified with the Wilderness Workshop, which I'm ready now to step away from that identity and develop a new one. Okay. And I'm not quite sure what that is yet, frankly.
It's an interesting place.
Yeah, it is. It's fertile, and I'm actually very open-minded and excited about what might be next.
Well, I want to say thank you.
You're welcome.
For all of those years of your environmental activism and championing the wilderness. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Amy. I appreciate that. And I want to thank you, too, because you've been, you and Katie and Kay, a little shameless plug here, have been great opportunities for us to get our message out beyond sound bites so that we can talk about it a little more in depth in ways that the people can have an opportunity to hear it.
Well, I'm glad we could. And Will Rausch, best of luck with this, and I'm sure that we'll be hearing from you quite a bit down the road.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks for listening to Valley Voices on KDNK. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.